Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, this is World Form Zen Fighting Champion John Chung, and you're listening to the AMAA Legends and Pioneers Radio Blog Show with Professor Gary Lee and the Sport Karate Museum Archives, protecting the history, one warrior at a time. Enjoy.
Good evening, everyone. Aloha. My name
Aloha,
is Professor
everybody.
Gary Lee, and I am the host of the Sport Karate Museum Archive Show, which is the AMAAA radio show, and we have interviews that we do every Tuesday night, and tonight I have a very special interview with a man that's part of the history of American martial arts. I'm going to bring him on in just a few minutes. But before we do, I just want to say thank you again for letting us come into your home on this evening and talk about martial arts in America. You know, our program is based upon a lot of things, but one of the things that we've done and worked on for the past year is the Legends Martial Arts Who's Who book. And the Legends book that will be coming out in 2017 will be featuring people's stories of what they've done throughout the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s in America. If you're interested in learning more about that book, you can contact Hachi Jesse Bowen directly at 919-618-80. Now, we have book signings all across America in the various events. And we've got some upcoming events coming up. That particularly one I want to mention is the August 4th and 5th event, which is the Legends Banquet. Well, Dennis Brown, a director from NASCA and one of the premier events in America, he'll be hosting the Legends Banquet with Hachi Jesse Bowen. But they'll be honoring Grandmaster Jun Ri with guest speakers Bill Walsh, Master Joe Corley, Master Jeff Smith, Master Bill Clark, and there'll be a group of people there that if you're a fan, you're going to really have a good time. If you're a competitor, you need to be there because you'll be seeing people that you haven't seen probably in 30 or 40 years. It's a really, really incredible reunion. Plus, you got the tournament, the U.S. Capitol Classics. Also coming up, right after that event, on August 11th, 12th, and 13th, will be our friends, the Gathering of Eagles. And particularly my guests tonight, we're going to be talking about a little bit. But the Gathering of Eagles is put together, originally formed by a gentleman named Mr. Al Tracy, but he's given it now to Dr. Nick Chamberlain, who is taking it to another level. And this year, there'll be dozens of seminars, all kinds of activities geared toward a Kempo theme of Hawaiian martial arts, but welcome to all Kempo stylists. Black Belt Hall of Fame, and even to recognize some of the top Kempo people in the country. So these are some upcoming events that are coming up, and later on the show we'll talk about a few more. But right now I want to talk about our theme tonight. And our theme tonight is based upon a style that was brought here to America, I say to the mainland, from Hawaii. And it really is the first hybrid style of martial arts, I would say, that's recognized worldwide. And, you know, Kempo is a little bit different because Kempo doesn't just rely on point A to point B, straight line, and circle based upon your blocks. It's based upon that. But also the surviving. The tiger, the crane, the snake, the imaginary dragon. It's what makes Kempo fascinating because it isn't just karate do. My guest tonight, Dennis Knasker Sr., knows Kempo karate. He has extensive knowledge in all Kempo. However, when it comes to American Kempo karate, that was under the old man, as his close personal friends call Mr. Ed Parker Sr. Rest in peace, sir. Dennis was one of his loyal students, studying and training with some of the best Kempo animals in the history of American Kempo Karate, making black belt on February 14th, 1976, on Valentine's Day, under Gary Swan and the great Steve LeBounty. He was trained with men like Frank Trejo, Bob White, John Sepulveda, Brian Duffy, Jeff Speakman, Tom Kelly, rest in peace. These are just a few of the men that he's fought, and he's fought some of them too. Other fighters, he's fought best fighters around the country through the years. We will talk about his influence of life, adventures, to help change his journey through his listening to his high school principal, Mr. Bolin. We will talk about the Ed Parker years and the explosion of the 10th degree black belts in Kempo after Mr. Parker passed, the phony certificates floating around, and the man who insulted American Kempo by thinking they could get by with it. He taught it, the wisdom of Mr. Parker, and he will always carry on through this incredible brother of Kempo Karate. Well, you know, then the Masters, I love the AMAA, Masters Legends Name Game, and his encounters with some of the great martial artists throughout the years, people like Mike Stone, Chuck Norris, Steve LeBounty, John Sepulveda, Brian Duffy, Bob White, Joe Lewis, rest in peace, Mike DeRoe Moore, yeah, John the Tibbethead, Tom Kelly, rest in peace, brother, Fred Trejo, and a few others, if we get time to throw them in. Hey, please welcome Mr. Dennis Kanasta Sr. to the AMAA, Masters Radio Pioneers and Legends Show, Parts Unknown. Hey, Dennis, are you there, brother?
Hey, mahalo, Mr. Ian.
Hey, brother, how you doing? It was good to see you, brother. You think we're making people go crazy for a few minutes?
Yeah.
I'm worried, Mike, if she was listening, that we'd be talking Hawaii liberish, and we did that for a few seconds, and that's how people talk. Let's start off with something really cool. Do your imitation of the old man, just for our listeners who love Kempo. Please.
I just wanted to talk to you, Gary, about the show and keep my art alive, even though it's like some 27 years later after I've gone. And I used to say in my book, about why things, the Zen of Kempo, it said, the greatness of a man is not what he does on the earth, but how long he's remembered from the grave. And I appreciate you doing this and taking care of all my people and my boys here, especially Dennis, Skip Hancock, Lee Red Lake, LeBounty, Brian, all the guys out there, Bob White, rest in peace, Tom Kelly, and all the other guys out there. So, yeah, I want to thank you very much from one island boy to another. Thank you very much.
I love it. I got to throw this in here, too. I knew it. I love the fact that when you were, I forget what event we were all at, but Frank Trejo walked in, and you did an imitation of the old man, Mr. Parker. And he turned around, and he looked. And, of course, Mr. Parker had already lost him, and he looked, and he goes, what's going on? And there you were. And there was some tears shed that day. Tell me about that. What happened? I'll tell that story.
Well, it was the very first time that I went to see Frank after he had his left hand amputated, and he was in a rehab center. So I walked in, and he was in a wheelchair facing the other direction. He didn't even know I was coming. So I'm walking down the hall. I get about 10 feet behind him, and I go, hey, excuse me. I'm looking for a man named Frank Trejo. He used to run my school in Pasadena. Anybody know what that is? And Frank turned around, and he goes, wow. I thought the old man just walked in. And so we went and sat down and started talking, and after we talked for a couple of minutes, he comes over, puts his head on my shoulder, starts crying. Of course, then I start crying. He goes, man, you sounded just like the old man. Man, it really, really got to me.
Yeah, that's a good story. Now, you trained with Gary Swan and Steve LeBounty, who are just two really incredible Kempo martial artists. But Gary Swan particularly, I hate him. I never beat him. He was so beautiful. He did a broadsword for him, and I say it out of respect. I never hated him, but I sure respected him. He was just an incredible performer, and Mr. LeBounty, master teacher, to be under them and get your black belt and that lineage of Mr. Parker, that's pretty impressive. But you've been around a long time, Dennis. Tell me about some of the people you fought.
Well, you know, just for a moment, let me, if I can interject in there right now. I know we had a right now Mr. Swan's running a moratorium or memorial service for one of our black belts by the name of Tony Martinez. Now, it's not the Tony Martinez in Utah. This is another one that was in Flagstaff. Just happened to have the same name, but he passed away a week or two ago, and so Brian's down there and Mr. Swan's down there having this memorial service for Tony. Rest in peace. But he taught me a lot, this guy. We'll talk about that maybe later, but just wanted to have everybody, you know, let everybody know. A lot of people probably didn't know that Tony Martinez died. And again, this is not the Tony Martinez in Utah. He's still doing fine. This is another one that was under Gary Swan. But that's just an interjection there. Now, as far as me goes, I started with a guy named Ronnie Coons.
Well, our condolences. Thank you for saying that. Thank you taking time to share that with us.
Thank you. And I started with a guy named Ronnie Coons. Got my black belt under him, under LeBounty and Swan. And then he kind of started drifting away, and so he turned me on to Mr. Swan to actually study with him. And I studied with him for maybe a year, and we had some differences, and I was able to go to Mr. LeBounty. And I studied with him for a period of time. But then I got the opportunity to study with Mr. Parker in 78. So now I'm going to turn that down, right?
Right. Well, that's really, really
working. I kind of worked my lineage backwards. Kind of started one and kept hopscotching to the next one until I finally got to the top. And I'll tell you, it was nothing short of miraculous and wonderful. I'm so blessed and so honored to have had my lineage. I'm very proud of my lineage.
Well, absolutely. And you know, the family is a Kempo family. I know that, being from Hawaii and being a part of a Kempo lineage. I understand that, you know, one of the things I wanted to talk about tonight was the differentialities of Kempo and the different flavors of Kempo. I kind of opened up, if you listen, to the fact that, yes, we're all Asian influenced, but, you know, sport karate was born here in America, but Kempo wasn't really about sport karate. Kempo was about self-defense, and it was pure self-defense. And also the thing about I love about Kempo is that it had the animal instinct of surviving. How did American Kempo that Mr. Parker brought here to America from Hawaii, how, when he passed that on, how is it so different that you grabbed it like you did, Dennis, and made it your system?
Well, you know, originally Mr. Parker started with Frank Chow, and then Frank Chow essentially said, hey, give me a talk to my brother here, and put him on the Kwai Sun Chow. And so that's how that started. And then, of course, at that same time, Professor Chow had like five guys that were main guys, Mr. Parker being one of them, you know, and a few guys. So Imperato was another. And, you know, Imperato kind of broke off and started the Kachi Kembo thing, which is probably the original mixed martial art, you know, karate, judo, kempo,
right,
boxing, you know. And so they kind of broke off and did their own kind of flair on that. And Chow wasn't extremely happy with that, I don't think, to say the truth. But these guys kind of broke off as Parker came to Utah to study at BYU, get his degree in psychology and sociology, because he needed to be dealing with people. What a brilliant move that was. He was just a brilliant man. And he, from what he started with in the 50s or late 40s, actually, and what he's evolved, he was constantly evolving something, you know, learning something new. He was watching himself, for example, on an 8mm projector, watching his moves, and he wanted to run it back. So as he ran it back, he saw that when you did a punch forward, when you run the film back, you're actually doing a back elbow. And so that gave him the concept of reverse motion. So everything's got a forward and reverse motion. So that was a kind of a milestone, amongst other ones. That was just one to illustrate, you know, that particular thing. But he kept evolving, and he did probably his greatest evolving, you know, through the 80s. So from 78 to 90, he started really organizing things. You know, it was a little bit haphazard, particularly back in the early days. Chuck Sullivan, I was just talking to him a little bit earlier, and he's probably the most senior man on the planet as far as Kempo goes, and that's Mr. Parker. And, you know, he remembers, you know, a lot of the stuff way back in the beginning, you know, same guys like Tom Bleeker and others like that. They were way back in the day. Of course, Tom Kelly was there, and he rest his soul. But his sons are kind of carrying it on. Tom Jr. is carrying it on in Pawnee, Oklahoma. So he's a great friend of mine, and I was a great friend of his dad, and so we have a good relationship. But Mr. Parker kept evolving this stuff, along with guys like Lee Wedlake and, of course, myself and Skip Hancock. I got to mention Skip. Skip's brilliant. Just an incredible theorist and great trainer. So as Mr. Parker went through the years.
That answered the question. It was something that Mr. Parker did, was that he constantly involved the self-defense, so it became improvement. And we'd take one thing and go to another, and it'd just be a consistent. One thing, we go back to our listeners, going back to Kaju Kempo. Kaju Kempo was, like you said, the first one of the first hybrid systems, because it did karate, ka, judo, ken, kempo, and bo for boxing. Now, you taught for Mr. Parker, correct?
Correct.
Yeah, and where was that studio?
Actually, I had my own studio, but I just converted everything over to him. I originally did the Tracy system up to Second Black, and I transferred over to running Mr. Parker's stuff because I was under him. So I go, well, I need to do exactly what you wanted. So I asked him to start me at the bottom and just go right through the stuff, which he gave me a lot of flack about it because he goes, oh, you know how to do that stuff. And I go, no, really, I'd like to just, if I'm teaching, I want to make sure, you know, if it's good, then good. We can move on. If not, I'm sure I can learn something, which I learned more than something on even beginning techniques. And he gave me a lot of insights. I mean, it just, I mean, the guy would just flood you with information. It was unbelievable. It was just wonderful. Can't tell you how blessed I am to have been there. And then my job is to pass it on, and I'm not going to be here forever, so I'm dying to just pass it on to everybody. That's why I'm so free with my knowledge, because I need to get it out there and to anybody that's willing to listen and do it.
Well, we appreciate you taking time with us tonight. Now, before Mr. Parker passed and Mr. Imperado passed, it was Kaju Kempo, American Kempo, and, of course, the Hawaiian Kempo. The difference, again, we labeled our show tonight Kempo Wars, and I don't mean that in the sense of wars, but I do mean the sense of the dispute. And we go back to, you said someone didn't like something. Go back and talk about that a minute. You said that Parker didn't like it, or Mr. Imperado, explain that to me.
No, I think Professor Chow was a little bit annoyed that these guys weren't, Mr. Parker always gave Chow credit, and what he said most of the time was Chow gave him the keys. He didn't teach him the techniques. The techniques kind of evolved through time, and there were many players, as Mr. Parker went through, the Tracys, Ron Chappelle, Tom Bleeker, Chuck Sullivan, Mike Pick. There's many people that he had influence from. Paul Mills, Paul Mills was a quick draw artist, so we started getting into the speed thing, and some of Paul's guys are the best guys you've ever seen doing techniques. And he's got the technique down for that. So the system kind of evolved through the relationships of these various people that would come into his life. The unfortunate thing is a lot of them came in and then they kind of left after a couple of years. There was guys like Huck Planus. And if I forget anybody, I'm not trying to forget you out there, at all. So, but all these guys had a major, play at some point in time with the system.
Yes, sir.
I mean, through the 80s, the guys that were there mostly were probably Skip Hancock and myself, and Lee Wedlake was there too. So, he was also teaching Speakman a little bit, and Hawkins and all that. And of course, Larry Tatum was there, and then he moved on. And so Larry doing his own thing. And, of course, Frank was there. And, then he passed, and then that just kind of shook up the whole apple chart. So everybody kind of went their own way.
Well, talking about shaking up the apple. Hey, Dennis, my brother. Talking about shaking up the apple jar, when the old man passed, and it saddened everybody, the whole community.
Right.
I want to ask you, what would you think of today, if he looked down upon us right now and see, for instance, the things that are going on with the 10th degree black belt thing that's going on in the Kempo community?
We have over 450 10th degrees. It's like unbelievable. And
how many? How many?
Over 450. My last count. I quit counting. Shit. Everybody's getting one now. So, but I think he'd make a road trip to every school that's out there and doing some house cleaning is what I think he'd be doing. So he didn't have the fortune of having the internet at his time and emails and all that kind of stuff. So it was very early at that point in time. And so had he been around for the last 28 years, We would have monumental. He was working on the tape series for the system, 30, 40 tapes of Junior was working on and did a phenomenal job. In fact, Junior right now is working on a kind of branching off and doing his own system called Pactrol, which I think is wonderful. It's kind of a nonviolent approach versus, here's Kempo doing the regular stuff that Kempo does. Well, he's kind of doing the nonviolent thing.
Hey, Dennis, my parts unknown question is, what rank was Master Parker when he passed? When he had
Mr. Parker?
Yes.
Ed Parker? Oh, he was a 10th.
Yes,
he's been a 10th for several years. Well,
he's been a
10th
for several years?
Oh, yeah. He was there for probably at least, 78, probably 10 years maybe. So he took
so
a 10th.
So it was how did he receive his 10th degree black belt? I'm just curious.
I asked that hard question, and a lot of people go, can you ask Ed Parker that? And we were sitting on the couch at the house, which was pretty normal for training, and I said, look, sir, and I had to be very ginger with this because I didn't want him to kick me out and never talk to me again. I didn't want to insult him, in any way. I said, I just have a question. I don't mean any disrespect, and I really don't care one way or the other because regardless, you always back your stuff with the premise to the system, which is logic. But I said, how did you get your 10th? He looks at me, kind of gives me the up eyebrow thing, and then kind of looks away for a second and comes back with me and thinks for a minute. Imperaro had promoted him at one point. And there was a lot of promotions he was been given from a lot of people. But what he told me was,
yes.
What I did was I looked out at the karate world at that time to his people like Masatatsu Oyama, Funakoshi and the downline that they had, and Goju with...
Yoshi Yamaguchi.
It wasn't Goshi, it was Gogen. Gogen Yamaguchi. So he looked at all that and, the judo thing. He had a judo background, too. So Jigoro Kano took all the jiu-jitsu stuff and turned it into a game, which is now judo, which means a gentle way. But he looked at all these people and he said he looked at what they had done and what he had done. Yamaguchi had done, particularly Masatatsu Oyama had done. And he kind of said, I kind of fashioned after whatever these men did is what I did. Well, he's got a ton of accomplishments, whereas if you take 90% of these sense today, one, they don't really know the system very well. And I'd love to do an intellectual gangbang with these guys and just go through the system. But, he always had his stuff backed by logic and he did a comparative analysis with these greats, and he kind of placed himself there. He didn't need anybody to promote him. He already had the system down, and nobody has paralleled him, at all with the innovative things that he's come up with. So a lot of people saying it's their new system and this and the other. Yeah, well, tell me what's new about it. Most of them have nothing new about it. It's just a regurgitation of the techniques or whatever, and that's really not new, So
right.
But anyway,
well,
that's
I got one more question with that. Dennis, I got one more hard question with that. If, if you got 450 10th degree black belts, which is a lot, who promoted them? If there's one American Kempo system, the Kaji Kempo guys, they're in their own world. I'm not going to talk about that because I don't know much about the Kaji Kempo people. But I do know about the American Kempo people, and I do know about Hawaiian Kempo. So I'm saying that who promoted the American Kempo people to the 10th degree black belt status?
Well, we all trace this stuff back to Chow. And, of course, that was part of Chow's thing that he wanted to be part of the promotion of all these guys.
Didn't he claim to be a 15th degree?
I think at one point he made some sort of claim. I'm not sure if that was serious or in jest. I know that there was a rumor.
Okay.
When I talked to him, he kind of downplayed it. And I'm not sure it was really real. A lot of people took it for real. But he also was supposed to get out in front of a train and was getting ready to punch out a train that was coming down the track. So these are colorful stories. I'm not sure how accurate and true they are. But anyway, so I think who promoted these guys? Well, there's obviously a thing out there called the Good Old Boy Club. And so the egos are so strong that, and I won't mention names or any of that kind of thing, but, you know, guys just started breaking off and started their own organization starting way back with, I mean, he wasn't even in the ground yet.
Right.
And there were moves that were shuffling to try to position for stuff. And I'm watching this, and I'm going, wow, you know, he's not even in the ground yet, and everybody's trying to shuffle for positions. And, you know, everyone wants a slice of the pie. I mean, it goes way back to Tracy, too. I mean, he saw an adventure and an opportunity in marketing, and so he broke off and did his own thing. He didn't want to, you know, be under anybody else, so he kind of did his own thing, started the Tracy system.
And he created an empire around the world. Exactly.
Basically, that's right.
Yeah.
And Mr.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Yeah, Mr. Parker himself, I was at the house a couple of times when, through the mid-80s, where all of a sudden you get a phone call, and he lip-synced to me, it's Al Tracy. So, as he got off the phone, you know, the thing is, they were closer than people led them to believe. Yeah, they had their little squirmish going, type thing going, but, you know, behind the scenes, you know, they actually talked, which a lot of people said, oh, man, they're going to kill each other. No, it wasn't really like that, you know what I mean? So I was there, and they took a couple of phone calls, and I'm going, wow, you're talking to Al Tracy? I thought you guys didn't want to even, you know, be on the same planet together. But, everybody basically started their own systems and kind of became the head of their little thing, much like Chow did, much like Mr. Parker did, and they kind of just started cutting out their own little niche and started, you know, growing, and so thus we got, just like Chow did, he had Parker break off, he had Thomas Young break off, he had Imperato break off, and so on and so forth. And before Imperato died, I know Gary Forback and John Bishop were two of my good Kajikimbo friends, and poor Gary. Gary spent a lot of time with C.J. Imperato, and he's just crazy guys. So they're doing the same thing with the Kajikimbo, so it's no different. You know, we're doing the same thing. Just guys want to do their own deal.
Dennis, I want to talk about one more thing. I'm not being negative, but I want to talk about the phony certificates that were out there, past 5-10 years of people signing a certificate and claiming to be the Parker signature and the Parker emblem. How do you feel about that? Is that pushing it too far? I remember when a certificate was priceless, and now they give them away like popcorn. I'm just saying, didn't it bother you that went on?
Well, yeah, of course it did. I mean, you know, one of my ex students, you know, formerly did that, and today with the advent of Photoshop and all that kind of thing, people took the original certificates, and you know, they could copy the signature down and just kind of make their own signatures. I mean, it cracks me up that you see being promoted by Ed Parker in 1995. And I'm going, wow, why wasn't I at the grave there when he came back out of there and signed the certificate?
What year did he pass away at the airport? What year?
He passed away in December of 90.
Okay, so you have a certificate that's signed by Ed Parker, 1995, and Mr. Parker passed away 5 years before him.
That's
what you're telling
me. Certificate. That's a rare certificate, brother. That's right. I mean, you know, some people, you know, put his name on there to kind of validate, you know, what they're doing. And, okay, is it right? No, not really. You know, and so, I mean, what are you going to do about it? Well, it's America. And in America, you can pretty much do anything you want. There is no karate police or kempo police out there. We kind of give people a hard time, and I just don't associate with them. So, you know, guys like that, I just, you know, make sure their name's out there like I did with you, with a particular individual, and Brian Duffy did. You know, so we let people know who these people are, and we just try to avoid them. We really can't stop them. What they're doing is the sad thing is they're preying on people that don't know, thinking these guys are something. And this one particular individual that you and I both know about, you didn't even meet Ed Parker. And he's saying he did and all that kind of thing, and he's an ex, you know, sniper vet and all that kind of stuff, and it's all hogwash, you know.
Well,
so,
you know, God bless those guys, and I understand what's going on, but I just wanted to mention it, the fact that, I don't want to talk about negative. I'm very positive, and this show is very positive, but I believe that people should understand that there's people out there that have misused their certificate venue, and also never, ever think of someone using someone's name. You know, I believe a person only has his signature, his handshake, and his word, and especially in the martial arts. So thank you for talking about that, and let's go on. I want to talk about the fact that the Internationals turned out to be one of the largest and most spectacular events that America had ever seen. It was definitely in the top four martial art events in the decades. Were you there when he had that vision of putting together the Internationals?
No, I was a little before my time, but I obviously pump anybody I can that's back in that era. I always pump them, and a lot of people think I was around in the 50s, maybe, because I've got so much information from guys. You know, I mean, I wish I could have met Scotty Loring, which was one of Mr. Parker's black belts in Pasadena, and he's up. Oh, I think he was about 5'11 or so, and probably around 190, 200 pounds. But he was just banging people off the walls. Everybody talks about Scotty that knew him with a high amount of respect. He's probably the toughest guy. I wish he got married, and the wife said, okay, no more karate. And he said, okay, done. And we've never heard from him since, so it's kind of sad. But yeah, people come and go and such.
Well, but, you know, on the vision of, again, the Internationals, how spectacular was the Long Beach Internationals Championships?
Well, when he threw it, you know, it was just a vision of what he wanted to kind of do. And so, in fact, the first one everybody thinks was 1964, which it was not. It was 63. And it wasn't, you know, a big thing. It was in a smaller location, all that kind of thing. Then he decided to go to the Long Beach Arena, and then, you know, from 64 on, then we started pulling the likes of Alan Steen. You know, of course, Mike Stone was the first one. Chuck Norris, Benny Arquitas, John Natividad. Donnie Williams. Steve Sanders. I mean, on and on and on. You know, Steve LeBounty and Tom Kelly fought one year, and then Tom Kelly went on to fight Joe Lewis. Joe beat him, I think, by one or two points in the finals. I think Joe took it 3 years in a row, and then Mr. Parker said, okay, no more seeing these guys. I'll seed you two rounds, but then after that, you got to fight your way up. Back in those early days, if you won the year before, all you did was wait for the finals and fight one guy. So you didn't have to fight at all or judge or nothing, and it was a lot easier. So he said, okay, we're going to end that. He made some people start fighting up. Interesting story about the Internationals in 63. Mike Stone had started, and he was a white belt at the time, and they took him back to the East Coast and went into a tournament, and his instructor put a brown belt on him. And he won the tournament. And so on the way back, and the reason he did that, because he was a white belt, he goes, man, this guy, how come this guy's not a black belt? He's killing all these people. So they put a brown belt on him. Well, the Internationals come around next in 63. So by this time, the guy says, well, okay, let's just put a black belt on him. So, I mean, he had like maybe 6 months of training or so. I'd have to ask Mike to be absolutely positive on these exact details. I mean, it's been a little bit foggy, but he won the Internationals, and then he won it again in 64. And basically, he had less than a year of training. He's just an incredible competitor. I mean, you play, if you know Mike Stone, if you want to play him in marbles, he'll play you until he wins. He will not lose.
Right.
He's that competitive. You know, Bob White used to tell me to play tennis with him, and Bob was a little bit better than Mike. And he'd play and play and play, and he'd lose. Mike goes to it. Well, after about four rounds, Mike Bob goes, okay, fine, I'm just going to let this guy win because I'll be here all damn night till he wins. That's just an insight into Mike Stone, how competitive he is. And he's such a, you know, just a very tough competitor, and what a unique individual. And I think he's kind of lost a little bit. I'm glad he's coming back a little bit because he was a keystone. I think he won 99 in a row black belt matches back in the day, which no, I don't think anybody has matched to this day that I know of anyway.
We're going to be talking about him. In a few minutes in the Legends name game, but I want to go back to Dennis and ask you a little bit.
Before you go on there, just a second, with the Internationals, that tournament spawned Chuck Norris and Bruce Lee, of course, in the 70-64 tournament where it was seen by producers, which spawned him into the Green Hornet. So just to kind of close that question, yeah, it was monumental, and it became the tournament to go to in the country. So
right.
I mean, it was incredible.
Well, I think it was Aaron Banks' event, the U.S. Championships, and the Long Beach Internationals. There were three of the big ones back then. But, again, thank you for that memory lane. But Dennis Kanaskier, what was your favorite technique? What was your favorite thing you love to hit people with?
Oh, wow. Probably my most memorable fight at the Long Beach Internationals was with Ray Sua, who had won the Internationals the year before.
Yeah.
And Ray was a Samoan, and he was my idol, really. So I'm sitting there, and there's a whole crowd around us. I mean, I'm feeling like I'm on What's Your Line or something, you know. And they went there to see me. They were there to see Ray. He was a fantastic kicker. Ray never kicked me once. He got the first point, and we just exchanged back and forth the punches, and he beat me 5-4. And but it was a great time. He's a hero of mine. Now he's been on the LA Police Department. But my techniques were pretty simple. I have two basic hand techniques and two basic foot techniques, with the back knuckle reverse punch, the roundhouse kick, and the side kick. Those are my four main techniques. And I was pretty good at taking people down. I love to take people down. So
sure,
that was a fun thing. Those are my four biggies.
Well, thank you so much for that answer. Listen, I'm going to take a short break. I do a couple sponsor talks, and I'll be back in just a few minutes. Stay on the line. I'll be right back with you with the Legends Name Game, and we'll be talking about some of our favorite people that we've come across, and you can tell me about their story, okay? Be right back.
Look forward to it. Be right back.
Absolutely. We're with Dennis Kanasky Sr., one of the Kempo legends of American martial arts, and thank you again for listening to our AMNA radio show. I'd like to thank our sponsors that have helped us get where we're at, of course, and that is, of course, Juventex, who helps us out, and they're a registration event sponsor that goes to tournaments and sets the televisions and the computers and really makes it a professional attitude when they go to tournaments. We also like to thank the Black Belt Magazine people, Mr. Floyd Burke and, Mr. Robert Young, who've been helping us from day one with the Sport Karate Museum Archives. Our friends at Century Fitness. And speaking of that, the Super Show coming up July the 6th through the 8th. It will be featuring some pretty incredible people. Our producer, Hansi Jesse Bowen, will be there live with our radio show and with the book signing and doing interviews, signing autographs. We're going to have the great Jim Buten, that's right, from the Blood and Guts area, signing there, having his book. Mr. Jimmy Tabares, the first star world championship, actually champion, will be there signing autographs, and Mr. Jim Butcher representing the Sport Karate Museum. That's the Super Show at the MGM Grand, Las Vegas, Nevada, July 6th through the 8th. I mentioned earlier the Gathering of Eagles, and a special guest that was confirmed going to be there, and that's Mr. Fred Villari. If you remember, the old-timers remember, he was actually the first person to create a martial arts shoe, way before Ringstar, way before Atomics. Kung Fu Shoe, which Floyd Villari invented, was one of the first ones. He will be at the Gathering of Eagles and will be honored. From his roots, from Nick Serio and Mr. Villari's roots, they produced so many people in the New England Kempo area. And we're very honored that he's going to be there in Dallas, August 11th through the 12th and 13th. We want to also remember that we have another book that I like to mention. It's called The Memoirs of an American Samurai. It's a book that I personally wrote. I'm telling the story of the Sport Karate Museum. If you'd like to know more about the museum archives, you can go to www.sportkaratemuseum.org. And it's really interesting. Lots of pictures, lots of stories, and it'll give you updates on what we're doing on our yearly basis. Speaking of that, we're having Kata Wars September the 29th and 30th. Just an exciting event. It's the 25th anniversary of Kata Wars, and starting off with a Jim Harrison tribute day. He's 80 years young, and we're going to dedicate the whole day on Friday, the September 29th, to him, leading up to a ninth-degree black belt test for world champion Ishmael Robles, world champion Troy Dorsey, and world champion Jimmy Tabares. And we will have special guest speakers, Mr. Steve Parks, Mr. Roy Kerbin. Honorable Judge Roy D. Kerbin will be the guest speaker for the Saturday Night Roast of Mr. George Minshew. Just a fun, fun event that's added with Kata Wars. And the idea of Kata Wars was to invite 15 grand champions throughout America for the year of 2017. Throwing 8 people from the museum as wild cards and have a national kata shootout. That's right. Houston, September 29th and 30th. Kata Wars. For more information, you can contact Sheehan Darlene McPherson Pagels at 281-221-2145 or the Sport Karate Museum at 713-483-0476. We thank you so much for supporting these events, and we're looking forward to see you. Please, please give us a call, and we'll give you more information if you need it. Well, going back with my special guest tonight, Mr. Dennis Kanasker, my Hawaiian brother. Dennis, you there, buddy?
Hey, bro, I'm here. Not going anywhere.
Okay. Well, I want to, you know, the Legends Name Game is something we started with the first show, and, you know, it's just a lot of fun. And you treat it like a fight. You got 2 minutes to tell me how you feel about that person and how that person influenced you. And, you know, then we'll go to the next person and so on. And so here we go. I like the first one. We talked about it for a few minutes, but just a little input. He actually came from the Philippines, and he cut the ribbon for the Sport Karate Museum Archives. And he was the first person I called when I came up with the idea in 1998 for this idea of a Sport Karate Museum for Sport Karate players. Talk about your friend Mike Stone.
You know, he was he'd done some seminars. He was touring around, right, doing his poems and things, and came into town. And so I couldn't miss the opportunity to bring him in the studio and talk to him more and get to know him a little bit better. Mike's quite interesting. I mean, we talked today, and he's still training in the Philippines. People are flying in now because he's kind of has emerged now to come back, and he realizes a lot of people need to go back to the root core of the martial arts, and a lot of them were there's too much fluff and puff out there. I mean, today, I mean, some of the tournaments today, I mean, some of these kids are incredibly acrobatic and stuff, but I don't see some of that stuff. It kind of misses the original purpose of the tournament where you go test your skills against another style or another person, and these guys are out there doing, you know, I mean, you got to be a gymnastics person, otherwise you have no choice or no chance. I mean, you know, and you get some incredible kickers like my hero, Grace, and what's her name? Gosh, I can't think of her name. Chloe Cynthia Rothrock and George Chung, those guys, but the one that does the scorpion kick, her name's slipping me right now. She kicks, she'll stand and look at you and left her both with her right foot over her head, and she's got a beyond 180 degrees, got a 250 degree angle of kicking. Well, she's Chloe Bruce, I think is her name. And so just an incredible female kicker and great martial artist, great forms for Silver in England is where she's from. And just a wonderful person. But Mike Stone is teaching people and trying to get them back to the roots and the core of the martial arts, you know, to get them to center themselves and, you know, kind of come from the core. Forget all that. I mean, there's only so many. I mean, Bruce Lee said a punch is a punch, a kick is a kick. But it's not learning a punch and a kick is not the whole deal. It's how you apply it. And if you can't apply what you've learned, it's just show. You're just as Steve LaBounty would say, you're just a poser. So
right. Yes, sir.
Gotta have effect.
Yes, sir. So you have a great relationship with Mike, and you're impressed with him. Let's go to our next person, please. Mr. Chuck Norris.
You know, I fought on 2-3 teams with him, and I hung around his brother Aaron a little bit, and you know, some of the guys, I was over in Vegas and stuff, so I was kind of honored to have them. They were short a guy, and I filled in for him, and he was a lot of fun. I knew him way back when he had his first wife and such, back when, and I mean, I remember LaBounty and I going and watching Good Guys Wear Black in his first movie, and we're looking at each other like, well, this is really dumb. That's not how he talks. That's not how he is. And he's, you know, he's using his regular voice. We're going, you know, to know the person personally, and to go watch a movie kind of kills the movie because you really can't get into the character because you know the guy and you know he's acting. So it was kind of an interesting thing with him.
Did you ever see him fight? Did you ever see him
fight? Sorry?
Did you ever see him fight in tournaments?
Oh, yeah. I fought one of his top guys in Vegas. The guy that won his tournament in Vegas came to Phoenix to do a tournament. One of Chuck's, I mean, Chuck was a kicker back when, and he had a move where he'd be lined up and he would do a 360, and it looks like he'd get a 360 turn kick of some sort, but then he wouldn't do the kick and he'd follow through with a punch. That was one of his signature moves. I mean, you know, he was also a good kicker too, but, you know, back in the day, you know, point karate, you know, had its place, and I think it still has its place today. I mean, MMA is just incredible. All these guys are kind of evolving to putting their toes on the line in terms of reality. But a lot of that was led by, you know, 40 years of control and coordination and all that kind of thing. And now they actually get to actually hit, which really puts the pedal to the metal and see if it's real or not. But, yeah, and these guys were very cagey back then. Bill Wallace, same thing. You know, and all the guys back then were just something to watch. And, you know, you always, anytime you had people like that were in the, you know, John the Giant Killer and the Tivadad, he always wanted to go see these guys fight and try to pick up a move. Byung Yu, I mean, they're just
hey, Dennis,
of
Dennis, I got a lot of guys here. You got to keep it under 2 minutes for me, please.
Okay,
buddy? Okay. Steve LeBounty, next guy. Steve LeBounty.
Probably one of the most spiritual and philosophical persons on the planet. What a great mentor to have. I mean, he's very down to earth. He's a kick punch, rock solid, have a strong base. If you got a lousy base, you know, the rest of your art's going to be lousy. So really, really press his basics, which is why Tom Kelly was good. LeBounty was his first instructor. And, you know, got him going. I mean, Huck Planus was Tom Kelly's student. I mean, Huck was under Tom.
Okay.
Tom Kelly, until he changed over with Mr. Parker. But LeBounty is just a basics fanatic. You know, you got to be well-rooted. You know, if you don't have a base, then he'll kick that base away.
Okay,
you don't have a base,
I got a hard question. Dennis, I got a hard question. You said Steve LeBounty was Huck Palinas' instructor?
Tom Kelly was Huck's instructor up to Greenbelt.
Okay, I'm just curious. What rank was Mr. Kelly?
Seventh.
When Mr. Parker died,
he was one of the sevens.
Okay, listen to me, please. I'm asking a question. So if he was seventh degree and Huck Palinas was under him, right? Seventh or sixth?
Well,
Huck Palinas one of those guys to promote himself to 10th degree black belt when the old man died?
Well, he was with Palonzo, and there's a whole story behind that. But the thing is, again, Huck was under Kelly till about Greenbelt. And from then on, Mr. Parker took him over. So Palonzo was promoted from first black to seventh black under Mr. Parker. And then when he died, then these guys broke off, and Palonzo and Kelly kind of, not Kelly, Palonzo and Huck kind of more or less, you know, partnered together and did whatever Palonzo did and such. So, you know, from there, I'm not sure. Nobody promoted or anything. You know, they just did it. And they were leaders, and they were very good at it. But
I appreciate that answer. That means a lot. I got one more guy for you. I got a couple more guys. John Sepulveda.
John's the sweetheart of Kempo, basically. He's I'm a little more explosive, you might say. Overwhelming, it would be another word, possibly. Still there?
Yes, sir.
Okay, I'm sure you can kick my phone off here. But John's just a really diplomatic, smooth, excellent instructor. He's got a great organization going. A lot of guys look to him. And he's just a wonderful Kempoist, number one, but also a wonderful individual, like most of these guys at the top are. But much respect for these guys.
Absolutely. How about our friend, who's been my friend for many, many years, Mr. Brian Duffy from Austin, Texas?
Well, Brian and I go back. Brian's basically my best friend in the world. And, you know, he and I have been through, you know, the fires of all kinds of things. And I can't say enough about Brian. He's been in Austin for a zillion years and introduced me to a bunch of people. Willie Nelson, his wife, Lee, sang with Willie Nelson's oldest daughter, Lana. So she introduced me to Lana, and so I got to meet her and so on and so forth. So that was kind of wonderful. I never got to meet Willie yet, but Brian's just an excellent martial artist. He's won a shitload of tournaments. Oops, sorry. Have to bleep that out. And I think he's won the international like five times or something in forms.
Yes.
And he went over to the – oh, he's very good, very good. And he went over to Romania or someplace and took a couple guys over there. And they took medals over there in the Kempo games or whatever it is over there too, 4 or 5 years ago. So he's done very well. He's just a great friend of mine. We always rub off each other. We you know, he'll show me something, I'll show him something, whatever. I'm the one that was responsible getting in with Mr.
I
Park.
Still can't, I can't get through his short hair. I still see him with that long, long ponytail in my vision.
Well, when
hey,
when
what
he
about,
cut his hair,
what about our... Go ahead. I'm sorry.
When he cut his hair, he then made a T-shirt with a ponytail on the back of it.
Well, you know, my first interview on the show when we first started the radio show was with this great guy and hero of mine, Mr. Bob White. Talk about him a little bit.
Mr. White's another of the guys, incredibly competitive. He's at a school in Orange County. He was under his original instructor was Bob Perry, who's passed away, rest his soul. And Bob was under Mr. Parker. And so Bob White's in Orange County there. Bob Perry was in, I can't remember the name of the town. It's close to Orange County there. Bob White's in Costa Mesa. He had a studio there running for 45 years or so. So it's a long time studio. It's a very successful studio. I got to put a plug into him right now. Tomorrow night, my good friend John Conway Jr., Johnny, it was a great fire back when, along with Angel Diaz, one of his students, Johnny's student, and he was a student of his father, John Conway Sr., who's passed away, rest his soul. He was one of the original sevens Mr. Parker promoted. But Johnny's doing a benefit for Mr. White tomorrow in Mr. White's studio. Bob White, unfortunately, has had a couple of bouts with cancer. He's had pancreas cancer, and now he's fighting throat cancer. So they're raising some money for him, much like we're doing for Frank Trejo, and a lot of people around the country and world are doing these benefits for these guys to help them out. And it's wonderful to see these guys. And these guys really deserve it because they've done so much for the art, both of them. And Bob White is just kind of – he's just a wonderful person, a man of God now. And he's just – I can't say enough about him. He's just a super guy.
Well, I'd like to say this. This year at the 25th anniversary, Mr. Mike Stone, I asked him to give out his Natural Fighter Award and to pick one individual to give it to. And of course, Mike called me back and he said, I'd like to give it to Bob White. And so this year at the 25th anniversary, I'm going to make that happen for Mike and Bob. I truly love Bob
awesome.
White. He's a great guy. Let's talk about old Firecracker herself, the one and only first lady of the five women that was rated in the top five women fighters in the very first ratings in America. I'm talking about Firecracker Mikey Rowe Moore. Talk about her a little bit. I know you're very close to her like I am, but you're a lot closer because you've known her for a longer time than I have. I'm the one that brought her out of the woodwork, but God bless her, man. She's such a hoot. And by the way, we're roasting her next year. That's right.
No, I know.
We're going to
roast
her.
I'm not sure if you, I'm not sure if you brought her out of the woodwork or not. Actually, Mikey and I go way back to the 70s, and I actually had a crush on her.
Weird. She was in
I know. Wait a minute. I mean, she was back there, and she was awesome. Her and everybody knows now she was the first woman. She got the women to have their own divisions. They had to fight with the men back then. She goes, I don't want to fight with men. So she, the story. She got the first division, and then Mr. Parker saw it and did it, and boom, that's history. So she did that, and she was a champion back then. She won the internationals. I know someone's trying to steal her trophy and that kind of thing, but she's the one that actually won it. And I used to talk to her. I knew Stuart, her ex-husband, and we would always flirt at the tournament. I was flirting with her, and you know, I was afraid of Stuart back then, so I didn't say anything. And had I known, I would have probably said, hey, let's go get a drink here and let Stuart mess around the tournament. Mikey's wonderful. I pulled her out.
How tough was she?
What's that?
How tough was she?
Mikey was pretty rowdy. She had a great front kick and a good back fist, you know. And she was under a Kazakhstan guy named Gaylord, under Grandmaster Gaylord. And so she was a pretty tough fighter for the day back then. She was top notch. And there were some other girls, come through the years, Linda Denley and other people that came on long after her. But she was one that kind of pioneered the whole thing, her and Gaspusin and some of those people back when.
Let me
ask you a whole bunch of
them. Let me ask you, Dennis, listen to me. Let me ask you one more question about Mikey. Why do you like her so much? I know why. I love her. I know why I like her, but I want to hear you.
Well,
why do you like her so much?
Well, her and I have a unique relationship. We went way back, and I ran into her again at the internationals, and her and Malaya were there, and they were outside with their husbands. And so I first time I'd met Dana, and Malaya was there with her son, and remember, you couldn't get them in there. That there was a problem with the tables.
Dennis, you
said
I'm the one that brought them there. I'm the one that got them there.
I know. And so Benny was going to leave if they didn't get in. So we all made a scene out there. And anyway, you got a table, and they were right next to me. And so that kind of did a great thing. So she was really nice. And so we kind of reconnected.
Okay, that's right.
So we kind of reconnected at that. And then we just kept the relationship going. And she came out to see me in Arizona and with her husband. And I just love them both. They're just both dear, dear people. And I got her into Brian's camp. I told Brian, hey, Brian, he didn't know who she was. So he came down there, and the women love her, and I brought her to back east for a seminar. We did a little bit back there, nothing great. So we got more stuff to do down the road. But I just like her because she's a real person. She's just a lot of fun. We give each other, you know, a lot of bunk a lot of times. She'll call me, and I know she's going to give me a phone call when we're done here and rag on me for something.
You said it in a nutshell, Dennis. You hit it in the net. She is a real person. That's what makes her so special. Let's go to the next guy. John the Tibbet Head. Okay, the giant killer.
Johnny was one of Chuck Norris's guys and a Mudaquan. And he, you know, Johnny was, they call him a giant killer. One week, Johnny was up and he's beating the best in the world. The next week, he'd lose to me, you know, and, you know, a nobody. And so he's kind of up and down. He needed more consistency back in the day. But, wow, what a fabulous competitor. I'll tell a quick story about John. We were in Vegas for a full contact thing, and he had his family there, and I sat in front of him. He was right behind me, and there was a guy behind him that was just yelling obscenities and probably drunk, and Johnny kept warning him a couple times to shut up, and finally, he called a guy out in the aisle. I'm going, oh, God, this ain't going to be good, and so I got up there, and I was right behind John, and John pops this guy and drops him, and he jumps in the air. He'd like to do this jump 360 and then stomp, you know, down. So he jumps up and I catch him. I go, John, John, John. So I pulled him away and I caught him in the air. And I'm thinking to myself, I just caught John the Tibbet. God, I hope he doesn't do an elbow and knock my head off. And so I pulled him off and then the cops came and everything was done and Johnny was there. So that's kind of one of my stories with Johnny. He, another great guy in Vegas. And now I'm glad he's back teaching. He's been for a few years now back teaching again. So a lot of talent there and a lot of history with Johnny the Tibbet.
Yes.
So,
yeah, one of my
what a great guy too.
Yeah, from one of my Hawaii heroes, without a doubt. I got a couple more for you. We talked about him earlier, Mr. Trejo. Talk about your relationship with him.
Oh boy, Frank and I go back a long ways. We fought together a lot of times. I like to work out with him. He was always a lot of fun. He was a great boxer when he was younger and way way thinner, and that was like amazing because he liked to weigh like 150 pounds or something. But he was a tough little guy. Used to work out with Danny Rodarty, and eventually he got to where he's running the Pasadena school for Mr. Parker. And there's a bunch of guys over there that were there, Yosh and some other guys there were main staples over there. So he was running that school, and Tato was running the Santa Monica school. But Frankie was a good fighter. He was on the Budweiser team. Great timing. Heart of a lion. Didn't want to lose, you know, but also just a genuine individual. You know, per se, and of course, right now, Frankie's, you know, he lost his left hand just above the wrist, and he lost both his legs to diabetes, and he had gout, and both his kidneys were failing, and he's on dialysis 5 days a week for 5 hours. He's blind in his left eye, and his right hand, he's missing all his fingers except his two middle ones. He's got the first stumps on there. So, I mean, I can't believe he's still going. He's just been in such pain. When I think about, you know, anybody that's having a hard time, I think of Frank, and Frank's just sitting there. He's got a great attitude, and we go there, and he goes, and we get him in the wheelchair and pull him out to the studio, and he teaches from the wheelchair, and he's still going. I think he just was with Planus at a Planus thing in Vegas. They honored Planus for Planus Day in Vegas or something, and I think they brought Frankie over there. So I'm glad he's out there, and I'll tell you what, the world is what's keeping Frank alive right now. God bless him. He was a warrior to say. I went to Australia with him, and we just had a blast down there. Did a demo for people, and it was just hilarious. We had a lot of fun.
Well, all our prayers and condolences and our attitude goes toward him. We love him, and we think about him, and please tell him when you see him next time, and I know you will, that Professor Gary Lee and the Sport Karate Museum Archives and all the History Generals Love him dearly. Okay, I got one more for you. The last one for the Legends Name Game. And, man, I used to love to watch this guy drop people, stomp them, do a full turnaround and stomp them one more time. The great Tom Kelly. Rest in peace, buddy. Tell me about Tom.
Mr. Kelly was an unbelievable, massive figure. I mean, I thought the guy was about 6 foot 12, maybe 7 foot 12, weighed 350 pounds. Oh, my God. This guy could kick you in the head. I'm going, how can he do that? I mean, this guy's big. But he was rooted like LeBounty. The guy had a solid base. I don't remember anybody ever sweeping Kelly, ever. If it happened, I never saw it. And so he and I struck up a relationship, and it just kind of grew from there. And he liked me, and I liked him. And we went out and partied back in the day, and when I was drinking, and guy, I couldn't keep up with him. We'd walk into a bar, and he'd just, like, challenge everybody when he was back in that inebriated state way back when. We're talking 35, 40 years ago maybe. And I'm going, oh, God, I'm glad he's with me. I hope he's not too drunk because, man, I'm going to die here. I can't walk and chew gum here. You know, I'm just, like, wasted. But everybody just kind of left him alone. He was just an ex-Marine that, you know, that made him – he said the Marines made him tough. I was talking to his son, Tom Jr., the other day, and he said, well, my dad, you see, the Marines made me tough, but LeBounty, you know, made me finesse and gave me the skill. So he already had the heart, you know, that the Marines gave him of a warrior to fight and engage. He had no qualms about engaging with somebody. So right. He was just amazing. He's very hardcore. He treats every. He never gave away any belts. His daughter Lisa, hell, she's been a blue belt now, I think, for 20 years maybe. I don't know. And Tommy Jr.'s trying to get her to move up, and she just won't, you know, do whatever. She's comfortable where she is, and so they won't promote her until she does what she needs to do. And so that's just the way they are. That's the Kelly tradition. So I'm kind of an adopted son, I think you might say, and I'm very proud of that. And I love the family, and I love all the kids, and they come and help them. I always do. We dearly miss their father, and it was just a crush to have him leave, you know. But we're all gone. We're not going to be here forever. So. Well,
yes,
me.
Yes,
I'm immortal. I'm immortal, so I'm a vampire. So.
Well, listen, thank you for playing the Legends Name Game with me and going over that incredible history of some of those incredible people. And, you know, I wanted to say the last part of the show for a special surprise for you and for our listeners. You know, a lot of people, you know, today in the way America is, you've got all these different award ceremonies and people get recognized, but when you're recognized by your peers and the majority of them all agree, that to me is a very special recognition and award. And the powers
right.
to be within the KIPPO community and Dr. Nick Chamberlain in the Gathering of Eagles, he told me last night, called me late. He was out with John Hutchison, one of the old USKA animals
right.
from the old day with Robert Trias. He said that wanted me to share with you that at the Gathering of Eagles this year, you're going to be recognized as a lifetime achievement recipient of the Gathering of Eagles and what you've done for KIPPO. So congratulations, Dennis Kanaska Sr. And, you know, for being one of the real deal guys in KIPPO Karate and also one of the real deal guys in the history. I know that I can always go to you and I can get a direct answer from any question that I ask about American KIPPO Karate. Same thing with Mr. White. Same thing with anybody else that I hand to choose them to be history generals for the Sport Karate Museum archives. And I treasure that I get to give those news to you that the Gathering of Eagles has chosen as a Lifetime Achievement Award. You know, I want to say one more thing, too. You know, Dennis, that you shared tonight, you know, And we talked about a lot of stuff. We talked about the KIPPO Wars. We want people to understand that KIPPO is a beautiful martial art. And it has its history like every other martial art. But it takes people and pioneers like yourself to keep it alive. And that's what this show's about, to keep it alive. That's why it's archived. That's why it's the podcast. This will be on the our show tomorrow morning on the radio network. And we emphasize again that if you haven't been a part of the Legends book or you haven't seen what it's about, call that number and talk to Hunchy Jesse Bowen at 919-618-8075. See what it's about to be part of that history. We want you to be part of the history of American martial arts. And remember, we were all Asian influence, but sport karate was born in America. Dennis, I appreciate your time here tonight, and I appreciate you giving me the history and dealing with my questions. And you're really a joy to be a part of the journey. And I thank you so much for being my friend.
I'm honored. I'm honored with the achievement. Well, I'm sure I really deserve that. I'm just a local. So, but that's just so nice. And I'm so flattered.
Well, you're a hardworking animal that we all love within the karate community. With that said, Hunchy Bowen, are you on the line, sir? Hunchy Bowen?
I think I put him to sleep.
Well, that's okay. I'm sure he'll be there in just a moment. But until he does come, I got one more question to ask you. Being a history general for the Sport Karate Museum Archives, what does that mean to you that all the work I've done for 20 years, I mean, you've been a part of it. What do you think the future of keeping the history alive in front of this new generation is important? Do you think it is important?
Well, I think what you've started and what you've done with specifically sport karate is incredible. I mean, you've got amassed the who's who of sport karate in general, totally across any kind of system lines. You've got Kempo, Kaja Kempo, Muay Kwan, Taekwondo, Chung De Kwan, Kung Fu, Ray Hildreth, a good friend of mine that does Buck Sam Kong's Hung Ga Kung Fu, Ray's been a great friend for a long time. Haven't seen him lately, but I know he's out there. But I think what you're doing to keep it alive with everybody and some of the gifts that you've gotten, I've got a special gift for you one of these days. I'll tell you later off the air, but I think what you're doing, I'd like to see it grow to where there's actually a location, 2,000, 5,000 square foot location.
It's the only location we have, but we're going to clone. We're going to take some of the stuff that we've got and actually make copies of it and clone it, like in Cleveland, in Florida. We're talking about a part in California. So the location here in Santa Fe is definitely going to grow. So, it's like this. When you work for something for more than 2 years, and I've done this for 20 years, the things I've collected and the things that have been given to the museum, it's literally priceless. In fact, we're going to do a show upcoming next month. There'll be nothing but the artifacts, all the stuff that we've collected for 20 years. And part of the stuff and the uniforms and the documents and the belts and all the cool things, it goes along with you, the history generals. Each one of those guys that's listed at the sportkaratemuseum.org, Dennis, they've been asked personally. I know that you can go to that list, and you could probably name 30 years of history of each one of those people because you know they're legitimate. That's what makes the alumni so special. So thank you for that compliment, and I will be working hard.
No, you're doing a great job, and I think preserving – I love that saying, preserving one word at a time. I think that's great. But, I mean, preserving that stuff, people have to know the history and traditions of where this thing evolved from to get to where it is today and then going into the future, So I think it's great. It's just, it's costly because it would be horrible to have a fire or something or a theft and have all this stuff. I know you're concerned with that. That's just part of the territory that goes with this kind of thing. But preserving all that stuff, you got some priceless things in there, belts and stuff from like Joe Louis or Bill Wallace. And I mean, just priceless stuff. These guys were huge. Benny Urquidez, my good friend Benny. And the list goes on. God, I know I'm going to forget somebody, but it's just incredible what you're doing. And I think it's great.
Last count on the inventory, and I still got two more sheds that I just pay rent on. Last count in the museum, there's over 1,000 items from the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s. And that includes everything from the bullet that Chuck shot J. Pat Burleson with on Texas Walker Ranger to 200 uniforms that have been autographed. It goes on and on and on. I mean, people think it's just pictures because they just assume, but they don't understand. The things that have been donated to what I've done has been pretty incredible. So we're going to dedicate a whole show to that.
Well, not only that, but I mean, you get guys like Robert Trias and, you know, some of these guys that were legends. And they're like, Trias was in Phoenix here, so I got the opportunity to know him and, of course, his daughter, Roberta, which I think was the first American black belt woman back in the day. And she came up under Trias. But he and I had many circumstances, but another day, another time for them. But a lot of those guys, Clem Evans, you know, the Trias International Award for a lot of guys, my good friend Mike Wall in Paradise Valley up here, he lets me come down. I split a studio with him sometimes. He lets me come. He's got a beautiful studio there, and he's carrying on the basic Sure New type movements. He's kind of evolving some stuff as well. But you're doing a job to make sure people don't forget about these guys like Trias and Mr. Parker and so on and so forth.
Well, hey, Auntie Bowen, are you there, sir? You got back yet?
I am actually here, sir. A little technical problem. I couldn't get things to come on, but I am here. And, guys, I've been listening to the show, and that was a really great show. And I think the last part that we've just talked about is, you know, keeping the history alive, keeping the martial arts alive, and preserving for the younger people that are coming up. And this is some of the things that, you know, we're trying to do through the show. We're trying to do through the book, and, you know, this year one of the things that we have strategies that we're trying to utilize is getting people to see the value of their story, the value of being a part of this, so they can share this with their students. And unlike an award, again, we're not an awards organization. You know, our whole thing is about building the brand of martial artists, to help people brand themselves, to help them grow their schools, become more educated in the martial arts through our seminars, our training programs. But the book provides that other tool that's really made our connection to the museum has made it so, you know, so valuable and getting people to as I've talked to many martial artists, and I know that, you know, we've been taught that, you know, we should be very humble, and we are, but I think we're missing the point that we're trying to make here is that so many martial artists, they have so much value, and that value, we need something, we need someone, we need a vehicle to start to make the change in our youth, and getting them involved in the martial arts. I know for, you know, myself, for the past 40-plus years, and with other martial arts, we realize the impact that the martial arts has had in our lives. And without, you know, the opportunity to become martial artists, to study the martial arts and to study other martial artists, you know, I don't know where I would be. And for many martial artists, who knows where we would be if we hadn't, you know, discovered the martial arts. So this is what the show, the museum, Who's Who in the Martial Arts is about. It's not about the ego of all the things I've accomplished. It's about sharing a story. If a child or a mom picks up a copy of Who's Who in the Martial Arts and they begin to read about your story, not about the 10,000 trophies you won, because when someone sees that first, that moves it too far over their head. They can't achieve that, or many times they don't want to achieve it. So the things that we're trying to do, we want martial artists to be excited about, is an opportunity and a vehicle to share their story to now inspire someone else to want to follow in the path of becoming a martial artist.
Well, Hanshi Bowen, I'd like to say on the air too publicly that we want to thank you. That's right. We want to thank you. Not only producing a show like this, but having the vision to carry on Jan Wallergroff's and Dale Brooks's vision of the Who's Who in the martial arts, but taking it to the next level of excellence, which you've done with this Legends book. And what you're doing August 4th and 5th with Mr. Brown, with Mr. Cordy, Mr. Smith, Four Master June Ree, it's really a big thank you. And that comes from not only the History Generals, but from the community in general. You are a visionary, and I want to thank you personally, and the listeners thank you also for the work you're involved with. I want to say also, I didn't get to mention it, that our next show will be with Mike McNamara, who is a top 10 rated fighter, It was under King Knutson, but now he is the security consultant and in charge of the Chicago Cubs and the Chicago Bulls security. So he'll be on next Tuesday night, and we'll be interviewing him and his career leading up to what he's doing now for Chicago. With that said, thank you again, Mr. Knasker Sr., for having the time to spend with me. Thank you again, Hunchy Bowen, for being who you are and what you've done for us and what you're doing through this book. We thank you again, and we hope that you enjoy the time you spent with us tonight, because we certainly have enjoyed spending time with you. On that behalf, aloha and much mahalo, and we'll see you next Tuesday night. Thank you.